help it. I knew she had no way to stop herself.
Which is why you felt you had to take your anger out on someone else.
It's not impossible.
I'd say it's quite likely.
It has a certain logic.
And what if, well, what if you had not been so clear in your own mind about her fundamental lack of culpability due to mental instability? What if you did feel that somehow she was to blame for her actions? Do you think your anger would have directed itself more appropriately, in the sense that you would have tried to take it out on her and not a relative stranger?
What are we talking about here? Is there something that I don't know about? How could she be to blame? My grandfather caught himself before the next logical question slipped out. Was the skinless horse real? Then he saw a look in Medved's face that made his heart want to rephrase the unasked question, come at it from the opposite side. Or had she been making the whole thing up? Medved sat without saying anything for an uncomfortably long time. He gripped the arms of his chair and pushed himself to his feet. He went to a large steel cabinet in the corner. Inside it, on steel shelves, were rows of thin cardboard boxes, lined up like books with their spines outward, 5 or 6 dozen. The spines of the boxes had blank white rectangles on each of which a patient's name had been written along with some dates. Each patient had at least 3 boxes. My grandmother had 7. Medved pointed to a chunky gray machine sitting on a low steel typing table beside the cabinet.
Know what that is?
A tape recorder. Looks like a Wallensack.
It is. I use it to record my sessions with patients.
He pointed to the boxes in the cabinet that had my grandmother's name on them.
These are my sessions with your wife. I can't share them with you, of course. I am not really supposed to characterize or paraphrase or even discuss them with you at all.
He closed the cabinet and sat back down. He grabbed hold of his cheeks and pulled on them, worked them between his fingers.
At first, there was not much of interest that she wanted to tell me. Her guard was up, not against me and my questions so much as against her tormentor. But once we began the Premarin treatment, well, it has had a profound effect on her symptoms and behavior,
on the pattern of her thoughts and the way she expresses them.
The effect has been so considerable that I am forced to question the earlier diagnosis of trauma-induced schizophrenia, and consider that all along your wife has been suffering from some kind of acute hormonal imbalance, some deficiency in the production of estradiol by her ovaries.
Unless that is schizophrenia.
Not out of the question, in females at any rate. Clearly, it's possible that estradiol played some critical role. We really know nothing at all about it. At any rate, as soon as the voice began to recede, as soon as her guard could be let down, she began to talk during our sessions with a freedom she had never had or felt before.
Naturally, I listened. And not only because that is what I am obligated and paid to do,
the account she gave of her experiences during the war, it was...
Medved settled his chin in his left palm, his left elbow resting on the desk. He looked out the window of his office at the sky turning black in the east.
"I will be honest. I really don't know how to finish that sentence," he said.
"I've heard it," my grandfather said.
"I know." "You have heard something. Have you heard everything?"
"I would have no way of knowing that."
"True. But let me ask you. When she talked about her family, her experiences during the war, circumstances of your daughter's birth, or set that to one side, generally speaking, in the course of your life with her, in her expressions of emotion and the patterns of her thought, would you say that there was a coherence to her? What we might call her presentation of self? Did it feel consistent?"
It was like when you climbed a stairway with the lights out, reached for the top step, and lurched into a hole in the dark. From that long-ago Sunday afternoon outside the doors of a Havas Shalom synagogue, when, from one day to the next, My grandmother seemed to have forgotten or switched off a supposedly acute aversion to the touch of animal skin. The answer to Dr. Medved's question had always been no.
"Here's what worries me," Medved said gently when my grandfather didn't say anything. "Because of the incident with the tree and your response to it. What if she were to tell you something or you learned something about her, her account of who she is, her history, that caused you to question everything she had told you before?"
"Sounds like I ought to tell her not to tell me," my grandfather said.
"Really?"
Dr. Medved looked surprised.
Maybe he was even a little disappointed.
"If she's feeling better, that's all I care about.
But as I suggested, I hope I made it clear. Of course we'll continue her on the Premarin, but there's no history of precedent here. I've never seen a case like hers, and there's no way of knowing whether the effects we're seeing will be durable, let alone permanent. If she should stop feeling better..."
"Whatever bad or ugly thing it is, Doc, whatever's at the bottom of whatever's the matter with my wife, I've already seen and heard it. I know it's ugly, and she hates herself for it.
I doubt it's quite as simple as that. It isn't something she did or didn't do, but the action of her particular hormonal, situation on a set of circumstances."
"Doc, I'm an engineer, an electrical engineer. That's my training. Engineers spend a lot of time on what's called failure analysis. Whether you're designing or testing or building, because you know things break, they fail, they explode, collapse, burn out. There's stress, fatigue, fracture. And you want to find out why it failed. That's part of your job. You want to figure out what's wrong so you can fix it. Maybe I used to look at my wife in that regard, at the beginning, maybe for a long time, wanting to know what went wrong, thinking I could fix her. But I don't want to think of her like that anymore, you know, looking for the bad capacitor. I just wanted to, I mean, I accept her, and I..." He was going to say that he loved my grandmother, but that didn't feel like something one man ought to bother another man with.
"She's broken. I'm broken," he said. "Everybody's broken. If she's not in misery anymore, I'll take it."
Dr. Medved blinked. It looked like he was organizing an argument in his thoughts.
"All right," he said. "You know yourself better than I do."
"Don't be too sure," my grandfather said.
There was a soft tap, and then the door swung open, and my grandmother was there. Hair curled, looking into him from somewhere on the far side of those damaged eyes, blue as the Monte Carlo night. Her face, all the angles of beauty and torment he had fallen for then, in spite of combat fatigue and a blanket disdain for sentimental conventions, at first sight. She was wearing the navy dress, the one she'd been wearing on admission to Greystone Park. It had a wide belt that cinched her waist very much to the advantage of her breasts and hips. She had put on a little weight, and that also proved advantageous.
"Hello, darling," my grandfather said. He got up and went to put his arms around her. He kissed her. It was meant only to be a kiss, hello, but it lasted a while and ended with her giving his lower lip the gentlest of bites. If the damn doctor were not there, with his diplomas and his bromo-seltzer and his useless addiction to the truth, my grandfather would have laid my grandmother on her belly across the desk in a shower of pens and paper clips, testing the connection that never seemed to fail. They parted. She looked at Dr. Medved, hopeful, afraid, wanting to know.
"It's okay?"
My grandfather glanced at the doctor.
Dr. Medved, on his feet now, looked at my grandfather, to my grandmother, and then back. He offered his final judgment on the situation, on the failure in her circuitry that my grandfather chose not to analyze.
"If it works for you," he said, "I guess it's okay."
A widower like my grandfather, Dr. Leo Medved died of heart failure in 1979. His professional correspondence and the records, stored in marbleized cardboard boxes, and still under seal of confidentiality, passed into the hands of his adult daughter and son. The Medved children tried to find an archive that might take their father's documents and tapes at the New Jersey Psychiatric Association, at Tulane and NYU, at the library of his synagogue in Fair Lawn. But there were an awful lot of boxes.
At least 250, according to his eldest child, Lorraine Medved-Engel, a retired school teacher and holotropic breathwork facilitator in Manteloke, New Jersey. I tracked Lorraine down in early 2013. I'd been thinking of writing a novel based on what I knew about my grandmother and her illness, and I was hoping I might find something useful in Dr. Medved's records. By the time I found my way to Lorraine Medved-Engel, the number of boxes had been reduced to 27 by vicissitude, disaster, and Dr. Medved's son, Wayne. Always sort of resentful slash worshipful about Dad, according to Lorraine, Wayne Medved consigned most of the boxes to a landfill shortly before taking his own life on the 10th anniversary of his father's death. Hurricane Sandy, on its way through Manteloke and Lorraine's basement in September 2012, had done for most of the rest of the boxes. Two of the remaining 27 boxes contained tape reels of treatment sessions from the mid-1960s, after Medved had left Greystone Park and gone into private practice in New York City. A few more held a small fraction of what must have been hundreds of Fisher Scientific notebooks, black covers, numbered gridded pages in which Medved set down treatment notes at the end of every workday. Unfortunately, none of these journals happened to coincide with my grandmother's time at Greystone Park. As far as I could determine over the course of 2 days' intrusion on Lorraine's hospitality, the sole trace of my grandmother in the surviving Medved records were two paragraphs and an entry that filled out the back pages of the lab notebook, in which the doctor had completed the writing of his unpublished memoir, Greystone Notes. Dated 11th November 1979, 2 days before his fatal heart attack, and headed Next Project, the 10-page entry outlines a book that Medved intended to call either The Bathyscaphe or Rapture of the Deep. It was to be a series of extended case studies, modeled on Robert Lindner's The 50-Minute Hour, culled from the pages of all those other Fisher notebooks consigned by poor Wayne Medved to Mulder in the Meadowlands. Medved laid out the narrative contours for 5 of a proposed 9 memorable dives he planned to revisit in his literary bathyscaphe. After these, running out of pages, and did he sense it? Time. Medved jotted down a few more paragraphs, sketching the 4 other cases he saw as likely candidates for inclusion. Among these last words of Dr. Leo Medved, I found this. The Skinless Horse, case of N. Blank, foundling, born around 1923. P., given name at birth, Lillian, was married woman of French-Belgian-Jewish ancestry, mother of adolescent female. Prior diagnosis, schizophrenia. Experienced hallucinations after 1947, primary auditory, some visual, delusional persecutor, skinless horse. P. told her mother was Jewish, mistress of married businessman from Ostend. Raised by Carmelite nuns outside Lille. Sporadic early hints of eventual symptomology, primarily auditory, angry or critical whispering voices, reported having seen burning angels in the fireplace, shadowy face alongside her own in mirror, etc. Late 1941, experienced return of vivid early memory, sight of engorged skinless penis of stallion, flashed through her mind while P. was engaged in sexual intercourse with a local SS captain, father of biological child, an act which P. only much later came to recognize as non-consensual. Prolonged acute depression postpartum. Retrospective indicative persecution mania paranoia at this time. However not marked, nor inappropriate to circumstances. Recovery coincided with P. forming close attachment to another Belgian Jewish girl, N. Blank, slightly younger, taken into hiding late 42 by nuns. P. claimed friendship with N. saved my life at time of suicidal ideation. N. was the daughter of wealthy tanners. Marocunier. N. gave vivid accounts of slaughter, skinning, treatment of hides, stench, etc. Strong physical resemblance between girls led to elaborate fantasy of being sisters. N. betrayed, deported to Auschwitz, presumed dead. Convent destroyed October 1944 by V-2 rocket. P. forced into months of vagrancy, cold, near starvation, stealing, prostitution for food and money. Experienced amenorrhea, hair loss. Regular menses never resumed. P.
He conceived only once post-war, 1952, see below. P's daughter spent part of time with Catholic family in Lille. War's end, P and daughter in DP camp, Wittenau, Germany. P observed HIAS agents with brief to bring Jewish ex-camp inmates to U.S. P managed to persuade agents that she was N, adopted N's name and identity. Started as impulse, seized opportunity, fabricated narrative based on fellow inmates' accounts of internment at Auschwitz, liberation. U.S. soldier with sewing needle and pen ink tattooed numbers on patient's arm in return for sex. Arrived U.S. July 1946, met husband, ex-GI, Baltimore. From hunger to plenty, illness to health, father for child. At this moment of apparent safety, symptoms begin to recur, worsen through circa September 1952 when P becomes pregnant. Experiences near total remission of illness during pregnancy. First hospitalization triggered by miscarriage around 10 weeks. After that, Medved gave some details about the nature of the skinless horse. He planned to conclude the case history with his own surprise when the routine administration of Premarin, derived, he noted, from the urine of horses, appeared to cure her delusions far more effectively than talk therapy had ever done. In the end, the chapter was to be a record of dumb luck and success through failure. This discovery that my genetic grandfather had been a Nazi, that my grandmother had been born to a life with a biography very different than the one I had always been told, that she had perpetrated such a charged deception on everyone for so long, messed me up for a long time. One by one, I began to subject my memories of my grandmother, of the things she had told me, and the way she had behaved, to a formal review, a kind of failure analysis, searching and testing them for their content of deceit, for the hidden presence in them of the truth. I kept what I had learned from my wife until I returned from Manilokin. I kept it from my mother and the rest of the world until I began to research and write this memoir, abandoning, repudiating, a novelistic approach to the material. Sometimes even lovers of fiction can be satisfied only by the truth. I felt like I needed to get my story straight, so to speak, in my mind and in my heart. I needed to work out, if I could, the relationship between the things I had heard and learned about my family and its history while growing up, and the things I now know to be true. "So what was it?" I asked my grandfather on an afternoon. It turned out to be the next to last afternoon of his life, a little over 13 years before I found the answer in Dr. Medved's notes. "What did Dr. Medved want to tell you about Mamie?"
"I don't know."
"You don't know? You never asked?"
"I didn't want to know. I still don't."
"Do you have any theories?"
"I did, probably the first few years. It was nothing I enjoyed thinking about, so eventually I stopped thinking about it."
"But do you think, I mean, it seems like he was hinting that she was lying to you about something, something from her past."
"She probably was. It's hardly unusual."
His tongue darted out, retreated. I handed him a cup of apple juice and spotted it while he took a sip. "Everything you've been telling me is true, though, right?"
"It's all the way I remember it happening," he said. "Beyond that, I make no guarantees."
I sat beside the bed with an uncomfortable sensation, a kind of premonition of shock about whatever it was that my grandmother had told Dr. Medved. I had already made the disquieting connection between the play my mother had told me about the night before, and which my grandmother had featured as Queen of the Moon, and a story my grandmother had told me when I was little. I had long since rediscovered the source of that story, of my grandmother's and the pages of The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, an edition with the Doré illustrations, which she had given to me as a gift.
"Look, Mike," my grandfather said, "it took your mom a long time to get over some of the things about Mamie that were hard on her. I mean, your grandmother always felt like she had been a bad mother, you know?"
"Yeah."
"I don't see it that way. The way I see it, she lived. She got your mother out of there. She loved her. So in my book, that's mother enough. But I don't want to give Mom a reason to doubt. So do me a favor. Don't say anything to your mother about this."
"Don't say anything to me about what?" said my mother, entering the room. She looked at me, then at my grandfather, suspicious.
Grandpa had a beer, I said. I think he's a little bit drunk.
Chapter 32
When I was little and we still lived in Flushing, the whip used to come shambling down our block, a hectic fanfare blowing from its loudspeaker horn. The whip was a truck with a carnival ride and a wire cage mounted on its flatbed, painted red and yellow like a circus tent. The music that attended its migrations and advertised its arrival had a slapstick wooziness, and in hindsight may have been a tarantella. It seemed as long and as looming as a tractor trailer to me, but it was probably no bigger than a moving van. If you were already in the street playing when the whip rolled up, you ran in to beg for a quarter. If you were indoors, you heard the drunken music and ran out to meet it with a quarter sweating against your palm. The whip man was a beefy, dark-skinned fellow in a billed cap who said little and smiled less, although he did not seem unfriendly. He would relieve you of your change and then help you up three steel stairs to the interior of the cage, where the whip's six cars waited, alternately red or yellow, arranged on a hidden track in an elongated oval. Sometimes the cars reminded me of tulips and sometimes of painted hands upturned to cup a pair of children. The cars wobbled around the oval, trundling along the straightaways, then picking up speed at each end in a burst that smashed you against the outside of the car, or the person beside you. During the slow parts, you recovered, and then you got smashed again. And when the ride was over, you went back down the stairs. Just before you exited his cage, the whip man would reach up to take a piece of bazooka bubblegum from a shelf over his head and press it into your hand with a murmured benediction. One day, as I came down the stairs from the back of the whip truck, I was surprised to find my father waiting for me in his suit, tie, and white coat. The rubber-tipped antlers of a stethoscope protruded from a hip pocket. There was a fleck of red on his shirt front that looked like blood, but was more likely to be his lunch. Tomato soup, ketchup. I knew that if I asked him, he would say it was blood. I had recently begun to understand that my father only rarely meant what he said, and that usually he meant precisely the opposite. If he said it was a gorgeous day, that meant it was snowing or raining. If he said something couldn't have happened to a nicer guy, then something bad had happened to someone who deserved it. When he was imparting information of a factual nature, you could generally take what he said at face value. But even then, you had to be careful. I had endured a painful day of teasing by the older kids on the block, after I cited my father's authority in claiming that the Crunchberries in Cap'n Crunch's Crunchberries cereal were made from actual dehydrated strawberries. "Does Mommy have a stomach flu?" I said. The only time I could remember my father having come home in the middle of a work day had been a few months earlier, when my mother fell ill and was too weak from vomiting to look after me. She had seemed fine at breakfast this morning, but I had been at my friend Roland's house since then, and in the meantime she must have succumbed. "She had to go to the hospital," my father said. He unlocked the car on my mother's side and held open the rear door. I got in. "Mrs. Kartakis drove her." "Does she have to have an operation?" I said. "Yes, but you don't have to worry, Mike. She's going to be fine." My father was wanting as a father, still less of a businessman, and as a crook, he was grossly incompetent, but he seems to have been a very good doctor. Among the gifts he could bring to bear was a fine bedside manner. I don't think I've ever seen finer. Like his mother-in-law telling a story, my father became a different person when he wanted to comfort you. His voice grew deeper and more gentle, and he seemed, uniquely at such moments, to relax. He looked you right in the eye. He knew you had questions. He understood your concerns. In the years that he spent practicing medicine, his patients always loved him. No doubt this manner had its effect on creditors and investors, too, up to a point. "It isn't serious," he said. "A minor procedure." He crouched beside the car and buckled my seatbelt, even though I had known how to buckle my own seatbelt for some time. "Don't worry, honey." "Okay." He put his hand with its manicured nails on my shoulder. A clean smell between peppermint and leather escaped the cuff of his lab coat. His class ring with its gemstone and cryptic inscription radiated strength like the ring of Hercules in the cartoons. If you held it to the sky, it might call down lightning. I looked at the glittering stone and the moons of his fingernails. I felt like crying about my mother having to go to the hospital, but I arrested the feeling at the back of my throat and managed to work it down. I asked my father what kind of operation my mother would be having. "What kind of operation do you think she might be having?" he said. He closed the door, and I was surprised to notice on the seat beside me a small suitcase, ivory leather, with spring-action brass clasps and hinges that creaked when you opened it. Scuffed as an old white Oxford shoe, it had been my father's when he was a boy, and was therefore always referred to as my valise, because that was what they had called a suitcase in my father's family. I took it to be a Yiddish word. I was not sure why my father wanted me to guess what kind of operation my mother was having. I wondered if I would be judged on the quality of my answer. I remembered that one of my valise-toting relatives, his late mother's sister Dottie, had recently gone into the hospital for a foot operation. "Maybe her feet?" I tried. "You're right," he said. "Very good." He switched on the radio, tuned as usual to WQXR. Someone was hitting the keys of a piano hard in fitful handfuls. My father turned up the volume. We drove down the street, past the whip. The angry piano tangled momentarily with the drunken trumpet pouring from the speaker horn over the whip's cab. My friend Roland and his brother Pierre stood at the whip's bottommost step, squinting hopefully up at the whip man. I realized that I was still holding the piece of bubblegum. I unwrapped it and put my jaw to work on it. I puzzled over the gag in the Bazooka Joe comic strip, which I was nearly capable of reading. I didn't ask my father about the valise. I assumed that I was going to stay with my mother in the hospital. I wondered if I would have a bed of my own or if I would be sharing a bed with her. I envisioned a room in New York Hospital, where my father had done his residency in orthopedics, the only hospital I really knew. After a while, I understood that we were going the wrong way for NYH and must be headed to a different hospital. I knew, of course, that New York City was full of hospitals. Montefiore, Presbyterian, St. Luke's. Mrs. Kartakis must have taken my mother to one of those. There were Jewish and Catholic hospitals. Maybe there were Greek hospitals. Maybe Mrs. Kartakis had taken my mother to the Public Health Service Hospital on Staten Island, where my father was currently posted. The piano was under heavy attack now. It must have been a Liszt waltz, maybe Rachmaninoff. It was so loud that I would almost have to shout to be heard over it, and my father didn't like it when I shouted over his music. It annoyed him, and sometimes if I did not shut up, annoyance slipped into anger. He would reach back and uncoil his right arm, slowly at first, and then with a sudden snap. His mighty Hercules ring would crack against my skull, making a sound that I could see a thunderclap behind my eyeballs. Therefore, I did not ask him if we would be riding the Staten Island ferry to visit my mother. It was only when it became clear that we were headed across the Bronx to Riverdale that I opened my mouth. Even then, I waited until the piece ended and a commercial came on before saying what I had to say. "I don't want to sleep over at Grandpa and Grandma's." "Oh, come on, Mike." It came out as irritable, halfway to yelling. He lowered his voice. "The puppets are not going to hurt you," he said in a controlled tone. "They are toys, you know that." "I know," I said. "I'm just afraid of them." "Why?"
"I don't know."
"Mike?"
"I just am."
A new piece began to play on the radio. My father turned down the volume, but drove on for a while without saying anything.
"Well, I don't know what to do about that," he said.
He sounded more sad than irritated. He sounded disappointed. I was very sorry to disappoint him, but it was hardly my fault that in a hat box at the top of the closet in the guest bedroom of my grandparents' apartment, a dozen hand puppets, a rubicund king, a sour-faced queen, a leering shepherd, two white and one black sheep, A sneaky-eyed fishwife, four musicians, and a masked robber with a black beard, made horribly from human hair, lay plotting in darkness to kill me while I slept. They had sewn bodies and painted wooden heads, carved by a master craftsman in Lille, France. I knew that they had cost my grandparents an arm and a leg, which intensified my shame and guilt over being terrified of them and, of course, merely helped the puppet's case against me. I tried to think of something I could say to mitigate my father's disappointment. "I'm just afraid of them at night," I said. "In the daytime, they don't bother me at all." The valise was heavy, and I struggled with it across the lobby of the building. The doorman, called Irish George, to distinguish him from another doorman known as Tall George, offered me a hand. I declined. I wanted my father to see that in spite of an emotional weakness that made me fear hand puppets, I could at least carry my own valise.
"Big strong fella you got there, Doc," said Irish George.
My father pushed the up button and stood back appraising me for a moment before lowering his eyes to his floor-shine loafers.
"He's a big boy," my father agreed.
He still sounded disappointed, I thought, but in a regretful way, as if mostly disappointed in himself. Mistaking incapacity for a philosophy of life, my father did not often apologize, but when he did, he would first look down at his shoes. It hurt my heart to see him hang his head that way. I couldn't handle it. I did not want him to apologize for whatever was making him feel sorry. I looked at the gondola instead. There was a beauty salon on the ground floor of my grandparents' building. It had an Italian name and a Venetian theme, and in the lobby a sign that was a miniature replica of a gondola. The gondola hung from the ceiling by the elevator. It was nearly 2 feet long, piano black with red and gold trim, its prow pointed at the hallway that led to the beauty salon. I had been enchanted by this model gondola for as long as I could remember, and now, not for the first time, I sought refuge aboard it, and began poling slowly in my imagination through waters untroubled by thoughts of the robber with his veritable beard, or the bad thing happening to my mother that my father was so sorry about, or the chances that, once she and I were alone, my grandmother would find herself in a storytelling mood.
"Is Grandpa home?" I said.
"Of course not. He's at work."
"Okay.
Why do you ask?" I said that I had just been wondering. As soon as the elevator doors closed and we started to go up, I felt a gin of expectancy or dread, there was no difference, flicker to life in my belly. I ran my eyes from the 12th-floor button to the 14th and back. Recently I had come across a laminated card printed with the mourner's Kaddish in two alphabets, inside a copy of Errol Flynn's My Wicked, Wicked Ways, that had belonged to my other grandfather, my namesake. I wondered if, in spite of the effort made to protect the dummies of the world from their fear of bad luck, some residual 13th floor might not linger, hidden like that Kaddish between floors 12 and 14. When we got off the elevator, I let my father carry the suitcase and took his right hand between both of my own. I lagged behind a little, steeling myself for my part in the coming ritual. The doorbell was mounted under the peephole in a metal frame I could now reach without going up on tiptoe. The way it always worked was that I would ring and, wearing the same look of fresh mischief each time, my father would cover the peephole like a magician palming a coin. A moment later, in a worried voice, my grandmother would call out, "Who is it?" from the other side of the door, even though she knew it could only be us. The joke was that she was pretending to be worried, but the real joke, at least to my father, was that she was only pretending to pretend. He covered the peephole because he had noticed that his mother-in-law never opened a letter without first holding the envelope to a light, or a door without first peeping through the spy hole. A deadbolt would roll back with a ratcheting sound, a chain would rattle, and my grandparents' door would swing slowly open, and there would be nobody there. Here the joke was that it had been a ghost grandmother calling out, "Who is it?" My role was to step up and declare in my firmest tone, "There's no such thing as ghosts," and my grandmother would then emerge from behind the door and affirm in a reassuring tone that I was absolutely right.
Even though I had known for a long time that it was my grandmother hiding herself and not a ghost grandmother, when the invisible hand pulled open the door, I often would catch hold of my father's or mother's arm or take an involuntary step away. My parents would chuckle or chide me. They failed to understand that it was not the ghost that spooked me. It was the hidden grandmother. None of that happened this time. My father rang the doorbell. My grandmother opened the door. It was the middle of the afternoon, but she was still wearing her house coat. This was a kind of slender tent with a Nehru collar that buttoned up the front and fell to her ankles, violently patterned with red and purple opart oblongs. Today it would seem like the relic of an audacious moment in the history of mid-century design, but at the time I simply accepted it as routine loungewear for a grandmother. "Go in?" The bangles on her wrists clinked as she waved me into the apartment. "Put your things in the cabinet in the bedroom, in the chest of drawers." My father handed me the valise. "It's just a couple of days," he said. "Grandma will take you to buy a matchbox car." He pulled out his billfold and gave me 5 ones and a 5, a considerable sum. He frowned and extracted an additional $5 bill from the billfold. This one was frayed, stained, and missing a chip at one corner. He was the son of a print jobber, and until his uncle's fateful encounter at Jack Dempsey's with a 6-inch human skeleton, his family had clipped coupons, saved green stamps and tattered albums, and hoarded pennies in mayonnaise jars. I think there was something unbearable to my father, some imprisoning shame in the saving of money. It never hung around his wallet very long, but while it was there, he liked it clean and new. "Dirty," my grandmother said in mock sympathy as my father handed me the abominable 5. "And torn, pwah!" My father grabbed at the back of my head, ruffled my hair, and gave me a gentle shove toward the bedroom. I could feel them waiting until I was out of earshot to start talking about my mother. I took my time getting there. Across the living room windows, the palisades rippled like a stone flag banded with river, trees, and sky. A cast metal Degas ballerina on a teak console leveled her contemptuous gaze at a balsa wood model of a Vanguard rocket on a bookshelf by the hall. When I went into the guest bedroom, my grandmother and my father started talking in low voices. I set the suitcase on the bed and stood in the doorway, trying to eavesdrop. I suspected that my mother was already dead, that the operation on her feet had been a failure, or a fiction, and that everyone was conspiring to keep the information from me. Between the hushed tones, my grandmother's accent, and the elliptical nature of adult conversation, I could not catch the drift. I stared at the worn $5 bill in my hand, at the portrait of Abraham Lincoln, whose own mother had died when he was not much older than I was. I felt like I could see the loss in Abraham Lincoln's eyes. My father called out a goodbye, and a moment later my grandmother came into the guest bedroom to check on my progress unpacking. I had made no progress. I had been too busy trying to eavesdrop, and anyway, I was confused by my father's packing technique. He had mistaken pajama tops for pullovers and bathing trunks for short pants. He had packed 2 handkerchiefs. Handkerchiefs? He had thought to equip me with the fake pony skin cowboy vest that had been part of my most recent Halloween costume. There were 3 pairs of underpants, but 4 pairs of socks, one of them mismatched, and one my mother's. "Did Mommy die?" "No, little mouse," my grandmother said. "You will see her very soon. Now let's put your things away." She took a quick inventory of the contents of the valise. Just before she said it, I knew she was going to say, "Oh la la," an interjection I always enjoyed. She put everything but the buckaroo vest in the chest of drawers and said that we would get some things at Alexander's when we went to buy me a matchbox car with all that dirty money. I asked her what I should do about the vest. She told me I should put it on because she had a presentiment that we might need to be cowboys today, and if I wore the vest, it would establish a mood. "This will be our inspiration," she said, the first time I can remember having heard the word used. "I am inspired." She went into her bedroom, and when she came back, she was wearing a Pierre Cardin shearling cowboy coat and a pair of Ferragamo cowboy shoes,
with chased silver clasps on their stacked heels. She said that I should put the valise in the closet, but I ended up leaving it just outside the closet door. On the other side, in the hat box, the masked robber and his confederates bided their time. I was known by me as the Cheyenne Kid. My sidekick, or as she put it, Kickside, styled herself Tumblesweed Bill. Tumblesweed Bill had curious ideas about how cowboys talked, what they did, and the cowboy way of life. Her cowboy accent sounded like buckwheat on Little Rascals. Her cowboy walk looked like a sailor hornpipe performed in slow motion. She had assimilated the notion that cowpoke was another word for cowboy, and as we trotted to the bus from the Skyview to Fordham Road and Grand Concourse, she did a lot of poking among our imaginary herd with an invisible picador's lance, which she called an harpoon. The Cheyenne Kid and Tumblesweed Bill went to Alexander's and bought T-shirts, underpants, and a pair of shorts and a matchbox car. A Land Rover like they drove on Daktari, brown plastic luggage packed on its roof. Then Cheyenne and his Kickside came home and baked a tart tartan. As always, when she was in this kind of mood, the time passed swiftly. I forgot to worry about my mother for long stretches of the afternoon. The blue over New Jersey deepened and then faded. My grandfather was still at the office. Earlier, there had been talk about what he might want for his supper when he got home, but when Bill and Cheyenne ate an entire tart tartan, the question of the night's menu lost its urgency. Tumblesweed Bill, to my dismay, seemed to vanish along with the daylight and my grandmother's half of the pie. Her voice darkened. Her eyes went sad. A new mood was gathering the folds of its cloak around her. I had seen it happen before. "What you want to do now, Bill?" I tried. My grandmother didn't reply, but at first seemed to be considering the possible responses. After a moment, she began to pinch and press at a certain spot at the base of her skull. She got up from the table, and from the expression on her face, you would have said that she had just delivered herself an opinion in the matter of what we ought to do next, even though she had said nothing at all. I had seen that happen before, too. She stood in the middle of the kitchen, frowning, as if she had forgotten why she stood up. She opened a drawer, then another. She started rooting around until she found a tin of her Winterman's cigarillos. She clasped the tin in both hands and made a grateful sound, but then once again seemed to lose track of her intentions. She laid the tin of Winterman's against the place at the back of her neck. "Mamie," I said. I was surprised by how shaky and small my voice sounded. I was not afraid of my grandmother, exactly. I was never afraid of her except at those times when she was actively trying to scare me. I felt abandoned by her, or by my faithful Kickside, and as the sky darkened outside the windows and night came down, I started to think about the puppets again. I did not want to think about the puppets, or to be afraid of them. But before long, it would be time for bed, and already, in the imagined dark of their closet, I could see the shine on their lidless glass eyes. I could hear their voices whispering that my mother was dead. Before she had sent me out to play that morning, my mother had offered to tie my sneakers for me, even though she knew I could tie them myself. At the time, I had rebuffed her, but now her offer struck me as ominous. Knowing that she was about to die, she had wanted only to tie her little boy's shoes for him one last time, and I had refused her. "I want to hear a story," I said to my grandmother. I saw that I had surprised her. I had surprised myself. For my grandmother, enticing a story from the deck of fortune-telling cards was not like baking, going to the movies, or playing piquet. Her stories were like moods or fevers. They came over her. "You want to hear a story?" my grandmother said. I nodded. In fact, I didn't want to hear a story at all. Between my mother's operation and the half-intelligible rustlings from the closet, I had plenty to unsettle me already. She looked doubtful, and I hoped fiercely that she was going to decline, but she just looked at me, rubbing the tin of Winterman's against her nape. I decided to issue a retraction, but it got stuck in my throat, and I could not seem to dislodge it.
"Little mouse," my grandmother said, "don't cry." She came to me, put a hand on top of my head and tilted my face to hers. The hand slid down to caress my cheek. "I know you are worried, but don't worry." "All right?"
"Yeah."
"Yes?"
"Yes."
Go and get the cards." I went very slowly to find the tin of almond kisses and returned to the kitchen more slowly still. By the time I got back, I had managed to console myself with the idea that at least now my grandmother would not be abandoning me, which, of course, I now see must have been the impulse behind my asking for a story in the first place. When she acted out the parts and did all the different voices, it would be like a continuation of her turn as Tumbleweed Bill. And for however long it lasted, the story would prolong the hours until I was sent to bed, and the voices she gave to her characters would drown out the whisperings and insinuations from the hatbox in the closet. I gave the fortune-telling cards to my grandmother and sat down across the table from her. I watched her compose herself around the deck of cards, as if it held a quantity of something rare and important. Our eyes met, and then with a nod she broke open the deck and decanted its contents in a torrent from one hand to the other. The deck of cards became a wide, elastic band that she stretched and snapped and stretched again. She riffled the cards with her thumbs and sprang them with a flourish. Then she set the deck on the table in front of me. I cut it. I cut it again. I reached for the topmost card. Abruptly she covered my hand with hers. Her wedding ring struck my knuckles, and I cried out.
"No," she said. "Never mind."
I looked up, my fingers stinging, feeling reprimanded. Her cheeks were wet with tears. I could not remember having seen my grandmother cry. For some reason, the sight displeased me.
"Do you have a migraine?"
She shook her head. She opened her arms, and with a powerful reluctance, I got up and took a step in her direction. She grabbed me and pulled me to her chest. My grandmother's embrace was something implacable and impersonal. It was like an undertow or the impact of a concrete sidewalk. Her amber miasma of Chanel was too much, a mouthful of honey.
"You're choking me," I said.
"Ooh," she let go.
"I'm sorry."
She was smiling. There was something about her smile and the flush in her cheeks that made me feel I had done something unforgivable. Her hand went to the place on the back of her neck.
"Maybe I do feel the migraine coming, little mouse," she said. "I'm going to lie down. Grandpa, he is stopping to the hospital to see Mommy.
Then he will come home, and I can get up and make supper for us. It's okay?" After she left, I sat at the kitchen table, awash in guilt and regret that seemed disproportionate to the crime of simply having, for the 100th time, slipped free of her imprisoning arms. And she must have been crying, I understood now, because she was sad about whatever was happening, or had happened, to my mother. If only I had endured her embrace a moment or two longer, I might have been able to discover the truth. I decided I would make her some tea and take it to her with a wet cloth for her forehead. I would sit on the edge of her bed and wait until she felt a little better. And then, maybe, at last, someone would tell me what was really going on. While I waited for the kettle to boil, I went to the deck of cards on the kitchen table and turned over the topmost card. It was the lady, in her long skirts and hunting coat, standing by a stone bench in a garden. I turned over the second card. The coffin, adrift on a gaudy bed of flowers, blazoned with an ornate cross. My grandmother had explained to me that when you were telling fortunes, the coffin did not necessarily stand for death or dying. It might stand for anything that was coming to an end, or even for something that was beginning. The coffin had come up twice for me in the course of our time together. Once, in the story that resulted, my grandmother had transformed the coffin into a little boat employed by the grandmother of Moses to paddle anxiously down the Nile after his basket because she could not let him out of her sight. The other time it came up, the coffin had become a chest of iron into which a hapless escape artist named Peri Pudini
had been foolish enough to have himself sealed and thrown into the Hudson River. Nevertheless, I hated to see that card turn up. I pushed my chair back from the table and stood up. I stared down at the deck, knowing that I now had to turn over the third card. I had to turn over the third card, a rough voice whispered in my head, because the first card had been the lady and the second the coffin. And if I did not turn over the third card, then it would be true, for real and forever, that my mother was dead. I don't know how long I stood there trying to work up the courage to turn over the third card. I heard the creaking of the tea kettle. The electricity inside the clock on the wall hummed its unending note. A sharp, my grandfather had told me. The tap dripped, and the drops rang against the tart pan. When I turned the card over, it was going to be the bouquet, I decided, because my mother was dead, and though I had yet to attend one, I understood that for a funeral you needed a lot of flowers. On the other hand, said the whispering, which the clock, the kettle, and the tap could not drown out, if I failed to turn the card over, that would kill my mother. My thoughts circled this paradox like a bee I once saw chasing itself around a lamppost. I pressed my hands against the sides of my head in a vain attempt to slow them. Finally, I reached for the deck. There was a chiming of keys on a key ring. My grandfather sighed. "Somebody want to come and take the chain off?" I went to the door to let in my grandfather and his own enveloping smell, raincoat, cigarette smoke, the dusty and metallic innards of a typewriter. I had never been so relieved to see anyone in my life. He did not look like the father of a woman who was dead, or even, for that matter, of a woman who no longer had any feet. I wanted to hug him, but I was not sure how he would respond, since, from his point of view, all he had done was walk through his front door. It was not that he never hugged me, but there needed to be an occasion. He dropped his coat, briefcase, and the jumble of an evening paper on a nearby chair. He asked for a brief summary of my day, and I provided one. He was almost always in a cheerful mood in those days, when MRX and he were in their prime, but tonight his manner seemed a little wan. I told him that Mamie had a headache, and also that she had been crying, but I was not exactly sure why. I said that I was making her a cup of tea. "That's nice," he said. "You're a good boy, aren't you?" "Yes." He loosened his tie and unbuttoned his collar. I followed him back into the kitchen. "What's dinner? What's all this?" There were two dirty plates, two forks, and a tart pan in the sink, but he meant the cards. I could tell by his face that he knew what he was looking at and that seeing the cards made him upset. I decided not to answer either of his questions. I was afraid that he might throw the cards away. Before he could gather them up, I turned over the card that was now topmost on the deck. It was the child. Was I the child? I had to be the child. The coffin was my coffin, and the lady was my mother, grieving over the news of my death. I wondered how I was going to die. I suspected strongly that a gang of French puppets would be involved. I saw the puppets inching themselves like worms across the carpet in the guest bedroom, crawling up the side of the bed, creeping across my body in the darkness like groping hands. "Hey," my grandfather said, his tone gentle. He crouched down and turned me to face him. "Mike, look at me. Your mother's fine. Everything's going to be all right. Okay, she lost the baby, but that's a misnomer because it wasn't really a baby yet at all." That was how I learned that my mother had been pregnant, and that the pregnancy had miscarried, though I did not yet fully grasp that or the import in this context of a baby being lost. Someone had forgotten to tell my grandfather that I was not to be told. "All right," he said. He needed me to say it was all right so that we could stop talking about the lost baby and get it over with. I didn't say anything. Naturally, I had a lot of questions about the loss of babies, but I refused to ask them. I was angry. There had been a brother or a sister, and nobody had said a thing to me about it. Now that brother or sister was dead, and nobody had let me know that either. My grandfather sat down at the table in the chair my grandmother had been using. He picked up the deck of cards and riffled through them deliberately.
"What nonsense," he said. "She was wasting your time with this?"
"We were playing piquet."
"I count 36 cards," he said. "What kind of piquet is that?"
I felt I ought to try to protect my grandmother.
"Cowboy piquet?"
I ventured. It sounded plausible enough to me. He looked at me. I looked back at him. He nodded.
"How about I fry us some salami?" he said. While he was scrambling the eggs and chopping up 3 inches of a fat Hebrew national salami, I carried a cup of tea to my grandmother. She was sitting on the edge of the bed, talking softly into the bedroom extension. She sounded angry, with the particular sarcastic intonation that she reserved for my father. I don't remember if I ever really caught what she was saying to him. Hindsight and a taste for melodrama and some faint ghost of veritable memory inclined me to feel that there were words to this effect. "You are not now free to leave them." When she saw me come in, she gave her head one firm shake. She waved me and the cup of tea away. She mouthed the word "go." I turned and went back down along the hallway. The teacup jingled against the saucer with a sound like a ringing telephone. I sat down at the kitchen table. My grandfather had turned on the radio and turned it to the news. It was the usual obscurities of statistics and disaster. He was banging pans, rifling drawers, and slamming cabinets shut. Sometimes the news had that effect on him, in particular when it concerned Richard Nixon. But when the ads came on, this time he kept on banging and slamming. It occurred to me that, like my grandmother, he might be angry about the lost baby and my father's apparent role in its loss, but all of that was unclear to me. On the off chance that he was mad about the fortune-telling cards, however, I decided to throw him off the scent. Sometimes after he had played a round of solitaire, my grandfather used the cards to build a tower, though he always called it a house of cards. There were two ways to do it, a good way and a bad way. Most people did it the bad way, which formed a part of the understanding of human behavior that my grandfather passed on to me along with his lessons in playing card construction methods. With the bad way, you tilted pairs of cards against each other like precarious lean-tos and formed them into rows of triangles that you stacked, each story narrower by one lean-to than the one below it, to make one big triangle. This method was inherently unstable, and even if you executed flawlessly, you could build only a few stories high before the thing collapsed under its own weight. The good way was to stand 4 cards on their long edges, forming a pinwheel configuration that made a square cell where they came together. If you laid a card flat across the central square, you got a sturdy box that could support the weight of many stories. Each radiating vein of the pinwheel could in turn be interlocked with 3 fresh cards, and so by going outward and upward, you could erect something of substance and loft. Some of the cards I used hid and others revealed their faces. The mice, the clover, the scythe. I thought of the stories that my grandmother had built for me out of those cards when they had turned up in the past. I saw that my tower was made of stories in 2 senses of the word. I experienced this not as a pun, but as an enigmatic metaphor. I assumed there must be a reason that buildings were said to be made out of narratives, or conversely, that narratives were seen to be the stacked components of mysterious towers in some way I couldn't grasp. Maybe it had something to do, I thought, with the Tower of Babel. I wanted to ask my grandfather, but then I would have to explain to him exactly how my grandmother made use of the cards. I felt that he would approve of her telling stories, or at least the kind of stories she used to tell me, even less than he evidently approved of her telling fortunes. "Look at that," he said, casting a critical eye up and down my tower. He was holding a couple of plates and forks. "It's easy," I assured him. "These cards are really good for building with. That's why Mamie lets me use them." "Oh, is that why?"
He started to set 2 plates at the opposite end of the formica table.
"Yes, be careful, you'll knock it down."
"Going to have to come down sometime."
"No."
A counter furnished with a pair of bar stools divided the kitchen from the dining room.
He set two places there instead of on the table where my tower aspired. "That's what houses of cards do," my grandfather said, returning to the stove with a pan of salami and eggs. "It's proverbial."
"What's proverbial mean?"
"You know what proverbial means." He held out the frying pan so I could see it. He did his salami and eggs pancake style, pouring the scramble